I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. On Monday, Kansas City saw its second highest November snow total since 1923. The 5.8 inches of the white stuff it left behind saw residents combating icy roads and parents scrambling to find daycare as the public schools closed for 3 days. Today, city council members tell us what they heard from constituents on the state of their streets, and we want to know what grade you give the city on its snow clearing efforts. Then, historian Michael Beschloss looks at presidents who have led us into war. Who decides when we go to battle has changed, and we'll hear which commanders-in-chief have bypassed Congress in order to go to war. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. So, how satisfied were you with your city's snow removal efforts? If you live in Kansas City, there's a decent chance you weren't all that satisfied, with Kansas City Public Schools forced to close for, count them, 3 straight days because too many streets remained ice-covered. Many parents were seething. Now a look at why it was so tough to clear Kansas City streets and what was learned as the result of a very difficult storm. With us are two members of the Kansas City Council. They are Jermaine Reed, and also joining us is Quentin Lucas. Okay, I got both of you here. I'm glad to have it. Have you both. Okay, I'm just guessing here that you guys received a ton of phone calls the past few days about the conditions of the streets. Am I right about that, Councilman Lucas?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think we certainly have received a lot of calls, and certainly at every public meeting, we've had real issues because we mentioned the Kansas City public schools being closed for 3 days, but a number of our districts, including our Northland districts, et cetera, have had the same conditions. And frankly, I know our friends at North Kansas City School District, among others, have had real issues, and they're real cost every time that we have these repeated cancellations.
Councilman Reed, how many phone calls did you get the past few days?
Well, you know, I can't actually hear Councilman Lucas, so maybe a little difficult to probably do this interview with both of us, but I will answer the question that you just gave,
right,
that I have received several different calls in my office, but mainly many of them were just about the side streets. There were a couple of thoroughfares that were many people had questions about. But if I had to give a percentage, you know, I would tell you that people probably about 85% to 89% were satisfied with the actual snow removal process that the city has done over the past 3 days.
So, Councilman Reed, you're saying that most people were satisfied with what they saw the city doing out there.
Well, again, I haven't talked to every citizen in the city or certainly in the region, but just from my office standpoint, the type of calls that I have received, that has been my assessment personally. It's not a survey that has been conducted or anything, but just my own. And I will note that, of course, keep in mind that the city plows nearly 6,400 lane miles across 320 square miles in this entire city, and it takes nearly 24 hours for our snow crews to even make it past every single street in the city. And our main goal is to shore up that all of our main streets, our curbs, curb to curb, while creating passable lanes in our neighborhoods. And so it takes a little time, and it's something that all of us have to do. And this was our first snowfall for the actual winter.
Right. Councilman Lucas, were your constituents and the people you heard from as satisfied with the condition of the streets as Councilman Reed just laid out?
You know, in short, no. You know, I might get a crankier set, I guess. No, I mean, I had a lot of people that, even though there are certainly reasons why it's challenging each time that we have a storm to pick up on snow removal, I think there are a lot of people that were upset. I actually heard an innovative idea. A school board member from Kansas City Public Schools called me yesterday and said, is there a way the city can at least plow a few special kind of roads to make sure that we don't have those issues time and time again? So, you know, I heard a lot lot more kind of negative reaction. And there were certainly a lot of people that also kind of understood that this is the nature of storms and things refreeze, particularly when you get to 40 degrees and it freezes again. But, you know, I actually heard a lot of negatives. And frankly, I think that's in some ways justified. Folks pay for their services and they want to make sure we get these done.
What kind of grade would you give the city for its snow clearance efforts here, Councilman Reed?
For a grade, as I said earlier, I would give at least a 85 to 89, so I guess that is a B plus.
And Councilman Lucas, what would you say how well the city did?
You know, I'm a tough grader, I guess. I mean, I'd say we're doing a passing job, but anytime you have issues like this 3 days off, it's not where it needs to be. It needs to be better. So I would say, I'll give us a C minus to start, and certainly note we have improvement.
You know, Councilman Reed, one of the big issues here is that Kansas City can't match what some surrounding communities can do when it comes to removing snow. And, you know, and that poor comparison winds up galling a lot of people. You know, I know I drive through Westwood Hills, Kansas, on the way to the station here. I cross State Line Road and head into Kansas City, and the difference is absolutely night and day. How much of a problem is Kansas City's inability to compare favorably to surrounding communities?
Well, sure. You know, I also think you have to keep in mind exactly what I mentioned earlier, is that with nearly 6,400 lane miles across this entire 320 square miles of our entire city, I don't know if you compare the two, because it's almost apples and oranges, because their city and the lane miles that they actually have to plow are a lot different compared to our city here in Kansas City, Missouri. And so it is important, though, that we are doing it right. And I think from our perspective, you don't necessarily need to measure or minor and sort of the negatives. I think it's important for us to get it right. The crews that are working, our city employees that are on the front lines, they're actually citizens of this city as well. And it's important that for them to ensure that they're getting to every place. They only can work the 12-hour shifts. They've been working overtime. And so, yes, there has been, over the past couple of days, a little time, but you also have the temperatures that play a large role in that.
Right.
And we have to do everything we can to ensure we get it right. And we'll have a couple of more snowstorms. This isn't the first one. As a council member, I've been around here for a very long time, since 2011, and I've seen snow, and I haven't seen some snow, but I know that we're doing our best to ensure that we get it right. And I want to be able to defend our city employees who are working on the front lines to clean our city and ensure that everyone is safe as well.
I want to thank Councilman Jermaine Reed for joining us here. Councilman, I'm getting a little feedback when you're talking, so I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for joining
us
today.
No problem.
I sure appreciate it. You bet. Councilman Lucas, what about this notion that Kansas City never winds up comparing all that favorably to other surrounding communities?
I think it's an assessment that we need to deal with. I mean, I think one of the more novel ideas we could use is there even any way to contract with some of our neighboring jurisdictions? Let's think of a lot of those along the state line and get at least a mile into the city, some of those that are able to cover their roads in a more efficient and faster way to actually plow some of ours, certainly for a financial exchange. But, you know, I'm one of those who I certainly respect everybody who's part of it, but I think, you know, we have to do our jobs. It's not good enough to just say that we have people working. I think the next big step for us is to make sure that we actually are getting the job done. Schools aren't closed for 3 days. We don't have residents that are concerned and complaining. And so that's, you know, that's what I would look to. I see this as a learning opportunity because, frankly, you know, 5 inches of snow is not the craziest thing this city could see. We had an ice storm, I remember, 16 years ago that shut the city down for about a week. This was not that dramatic, and so we should be able to dig out faster.
Okay, let me get the thoughts of our listeners here. We're wondering what you think, how City Hall did this week in removing snow. You can call us right now, 816-235-2888. What would you like to see the city do differently next time? 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To rate you, I would say not good. I live downtown, and the streets downtown were really bad, including Main Street. So I would have...
You're breaking up a little bit. You're saying the streets downtown weren't all that great. And what else were you saying, Al? I think I've lost you here. Councilman Lucas, what did you think of the job City Crews did when it came to downtown streets?
You know, I don't ever want to disagree with people too much, but, you know, the areas of the city that I think we've actually done an okay job as, it's downtown, actually. I mean, mm-hmm. I think people are getting around fine around downtown. I've been down here every day, including on Sunday during the snowstorm, and that's not the greatest problem area. I think our biggest problem areas, when you look at some of our residential neighborhoods, particularly in East Kansas City, when you look at our residential neighborhoods in the Northland of Kansas City, that's where I think we've had real issues, particularly off of arterials. So, you know, I think our central business district's done well, certainly the Country Club Plaza. Some of those well-traveled places are good, but it's the neighborhoods where I think I'm hearing real concerns.
You know, the city always prioritizes its snow-clearing efforts, and the more heavily traveled streets typically in any city get more attention first. But you're saying, Quentin, that the city needs to focus even further down the food chain and get into the neighborhoods and right down to the pavement? Would that be sort of your sense of—
Yeah, you know, I think that would be the case. I mean, I think there's one thing that we could easily do, and I think it impacts schools. I mean, is there a way, right, that we can target, and we do this with our sidewalk paving, all that sort of stuff, you know, targeting streets that either have schools on them or are heavily traveled for school districts? Is there a way you can kind of work out this plan before the storms come so that when we're looking at school district cancellations and that sort of thing, that we have that taken care of? I think that's a step one. I think a step two is, yeah, how are we doing our type of removal? There's much talk about, you know, the snow melts and then, right, becomes liquid and comes back and freezes. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a way to try to do our treatment more actively thereafter? I think generally what we need to do is make sure that we're focusing on how to avoid this fairly consistent concern and complaint. You know, I recognize that I think people are always going to be kind of upset with this because this is a function of city government that we hear a lot about. But at the same time, I don't think it's enough to just dismiss it and say, you know, it's okay. Mm-hmm. So I think there are more innovative ways to really address these issues, because when you look at some other jurisdictions now in our metro that have a lot of lane miles, Overland Park, Kansas being one example, they certainly have a lot of tax money too, but nevertheless, you know, you're not hearing the same thing in some of the older neighborhoods, and that's something that we need to address.
You know, Councilman Lucas, is it fair to say the city has for years, at least my impression, looking from a little bit afar here, watching the city over the years, has tried to sort of save money when it came to snow removal, that there was sort of a deliberate thought given to the idea that snow removal is not going to be a place where we put a lot of resources?
You know, it was interesting preparing for the interview today. I read an interview with Mark Funkhauser some 8-9 years ago, and he was even fascinating then. But yes, I think it is something we don't always do. And then every 5 years or so, we introduce a new council ordinance or resolution, and everything was going to change. I mean, I think what you're seeing and what the public is seeing right now is the reality that we have not had a significant winter weather event like this in probably 3 years or 4 years.
Right.
And I think what you start to see is that we assign staff on a lot of different things. But I will make a very kind of, I think, clear budget point, which is that what we've also seen since the financial crisis is that we don't have the same body count at City Hall in some ways, right? We don't have the same number of folks. And I think it might be worthwhile to see, well, where do we have folks? Are we staffed up in public works? Is there a way that we can try to, you know, backfill some of these positions or have contracting ready? And frankly, it's the same issue we see in code enforcement sometimes, that we're kind of seeing in snow plowing, that we're seeing in lawn maintenance during the summer. And it's something that I think is fair for Kansas Cityans to critique.
Let's go to some phone calls as we grade how Kansas City did when it came to clearing streets of snow and ice this week. Let's go to David from Kansas City, Missouri. David, you're on with Councilman Quentin Lucas. Good morning.
Thank you. I wanted to stand up for the plow operators. This particular snow was different in that during the snow itself, visibility was very poor, and it was difficult to attack the streets just from a safety point of view. And I was on the night shift. When we came in, there wasn't any snow coming down, but the snow had set on the street long enough that when the blade hit it, frequently the blade would flop over in the front, and it would not scrape the snow.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it's a nature scientific thing that you can't get snow off the street sometimes.
I hear you. David, thank you for the phone call and the perspective. I appreciate it.
Sure enough.
Let's go to Kelly from historic Northeast Kansas City. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning, and good morning, Councilman Clinton. I just wanted to say the snow removal efforts in our neighborhood have been less than stellar. We are across the street from Gladstone Elementary School, and it is still a nightmare to get down the street. I've lived in Wisconsin for about 20 years. They know exactly how to make it work and not have snow like this shut down the city for 3 days.
You know, Jane, I'm from Minnesota, and I agree with your last comment. I'll just say, when it comes to snow removal, Kansas City is no Minneapolis. That's for sure. I appreciate your phone call, Jane. Thank you. Let's go to Jane from Brookside. Jane, you're on Up to Date.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My comment is that people are always talking about how the residential streets aren't cleared in certain parts of town. But our homes association, we pay dues. And this year we'll spend probably $12,000 to $14,000 in our budget for snow removal. It's not just an issue of clearing the streets for people to get to and from work and school. It's also an issue of getting the ambulance and the fire truck to our houses when we need them.
Right. Do lots of communities have neighborhood associations that pay for snow removal, Jane? Do you have any sense of that?
I'd say quite a few of them do.
Right. So these are supplementary efforts above and beyond what the city's able to do.
Exactly. We pay for our parks and islands maintenance. We pay for any seasonal decorations or parties we have on our parks and islands. And we pay for our snow removal. We also pay for security.
Right.
And the snow removal and the security used to be voluntary. Now they're mandatory.
Thank you, Jane, for calling. Councilman Lucas, what do you make of this notion that residents are having to pay further out of pocket to supplement city services like snow removal, like aiding the efforts of the police department when it comes to security?
Yeah. You know, I think it's unfortunate. I don't think that's what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, I think Kansas Cityans pay significant taxes to make sure these things are taken care of. I do police ride along sometimes. One of the hardest things for me to have seen was how long it takes sometimes if your house is broken into and the suspect's not there. It might take 2-3 hours for officers to get to you. And I think we're seeing this from the delivery and snow services, too. All of it is inappropriate. And frankly, I think what we need to do is see how we can work, I think, more efficiently, if that includes contracting with more. Kansas City, Missouri also had this issue recently with trash service and pickup up in the Northland in particular. And, it's something that is unacceptable, and I think we'll continue to try to push towards it. To the gentleman who was talking about how hard the snow was, I certainly recognize that, a lot of things were probably going to be closed on Monday. I think a lot of people, though, that have spoken to my office would say, what's the deal with Wednesday? And why is it that we're still hearing a lot about this? And, the other thing that I would say is to the last caller, there are a lot of neighborhood associations and groups that may be able to do this sort of thing in clearing, but there are many in Kansas City who can't. And what I don't want us to see is a grossly disproportionate response to the snow, depending upon your neighborhood's ability to help fund it.
You know, the city has set aside something like $2.7 million this year for snow removal, and I'm betting, Councilman, that the storm chewed through a lot of that. What happens if it snows a few more times and the city winds up going over budget in this area?
I mentioned a former mayor before, and I'll have to again, because I think that something like this happened in 2010. The city's answer at the time was just, well, let's pray for no more snow.
Yeah.
Now, I think we certainly have at City Hall, we have a better answer now. We certainly have contingency funds. And there are contingency funds that we can use to try to take care of this. You know, the negative of that would be that those will be contingency funds that we can't use for anything else. But in Kansas City, at any given point, has money in the bank to help handle these sorts of operations. So the people should be certain and assured that if we have a gigantic snowstorm in March, which has happened before, then we'll still be ready.
Let's go back to some phone calls as we talk about Kansas City's efforts at removing snow and ice this week. Russ, who's a FedEx driver working in the Kansas City, Missouri area. Russ, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm working right now, and I just... your story, and I was like, I've been working the last 3 days driving around, and I drive from 210 all the way out here to Belton Raymore.
Wow.
And the highways have been pretty good. Monday was kind of nasty, but the rest is
great.
How about this, the roads around neighborhoods, through neighborhoods, Russ? What did you see there?
The neighborhoods were good. Driveways, not so much.
Okay. Okay, I'm glad you called. Thanks for doing it, Russ. Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Jake from South Kansas City. Jake, good morning to you.
Good morning. I think expectations are just way too high. You know, it's a matter of money. It's that simple. The budget is what it is, and it's just, you know, people need to take three deep breaths, and it's winter, and it snows occasionally in the winter, and things are going to be inconvenient.
Right. Jake, okay. I appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Denise from South Kansas City. Denise, you're on the air.
Okay. I'm a retired city employee, and I know that we used to contract with a lot of small businesses to do, like, neighborhood snow removal. Are we still doing that?
Councilman, are we still contracting out for private folks to clear streets?
You know what? I mean, from what I've mainly heard, we're using our city trucks and crews and efforts. So if we are doing that, it certainly isn't a majority of our effort, but I would have to check on that to see if any of that's still being done. For the most part, it's Kansas City, Missouri staff and employees that are doing the work.
Okay. Denise, thank you for calling. And Councilman Lucas, thanks for fielding phone calls on, I know, was a pretty hot topic, and sure appreciate your time very much.
Good to be with you, Steve. Have a good one.
You too. Time for a break. When we come back, prominent presidential historian Michael Beschloss joins us to talk about presidents and war. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, newly elected Jackson County Sheriff Daryl Forte discussed his plans to repair a department that suffered from scandal and lax policies. You can hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker swings by to talk about the decision regarding marijuana prosecutions and the continuing crime and violence in the county. More tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas Senator Jerry Moran on Wednesday issued a statement saying he supports a war powers resolution aimed at Yemen. He must have read presidential historian Michael Beschloss's new book. Senator Moran believes it's Congress's responsibility to authorize military action. One major point that Michael Beschloss makes is that modern-day presidents should only go to war when there's overwhelming support from Congress and the public. In the past, Beschloss points out, presidents have pushed this country into wars that weren't essential for our national security. His book is Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times. He's also the author of several other presidential histories, including Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders, and How They Changed America. He's the NBC News presidential historian. Michael, welcome back. Sorry I missed you when you were in town.
Oh, same here, Steve, but glad to be together at least this way.
You bet. Well, today, you say here, presidents have way too much power when it comes to making war. How dangerous is this?
I think it's really dangerous because a president now has the power to get us involved in a major war almost single-handedly and almost overnight. You know, I am not saying that if there is, God forbid, a cyber attack or a terrorist attack or a Russian missile comes flying over the North Pole, a president should go to Congress for 2 weeks. But what the founders were really worried about at the beginning was that presidents would become dictators, or they would become new versions of the kings of England. And the way that they thought that would most happen would be in wartime, because in England, if a king got unpopular, the way he got himself popular again would be to come up with a fake reason for war. Country would go to war. Everyone would be united and loving the king again. And so the result is that if we read the Constitution says if there is to be a war, it has to be declared by Congress, not a president. Yet, last time Congress declared war was 1942, and I think there have been one or two major wars since then.
So what happened? Why did Congress give up such an important responsibility and important power? You know, big bodies like that don't look kindly on the idea of giving up power.
In most ways, but in wars they have. And what happened, I absolutely love Harry Truman, as you and I have talked about more than once. But in 1950, when the South Koreans were invaded by the North, Truman did the right thing, sent MacArthur and our armed forces to defend them. But then when Truman's aide said, "When are you going to Congress for the war declaration?" Truman said, "I don't have to. I admire James Polk. He told Congress to go to hell, and I'm going to do the same thing."
And that set a precedent that lingers to this day, right?
Yeah, and the problem is that 14 years later, when Lyndon Johnson was dealing with an incident of the Gulf of Tonkin off of North Vietnam, an incident that turns out not to have ever happened, he called it an unprovoked attack. He was asked, "When are you going to go to Congress to get them to declare war?" Johnson said, "Truman didn't do it. I don't have to either."
You know, the scary thing here is President Trump seems to be aware of this connection between, you know, approval ratings that you've mentioned and waging war. He's talked about this and some worry that he might start an unnecessary war to improve his poll numbers. How legitimate of a concern do you think that is?
I think any modern president is going to be tempted. In Donald Trump's case, he has noted, he said in public, that the great presidents are those who go to war. In 2011, he predicted that President Obama would start a war to get reelected in 2012. Not a great idea in your mind to connect the idea, if you're president, of going to war and becoming more popular. At the same time, it must be said, we're almost 2 years into this administration, and it has not happened, thank God.
What's an example of a president who pushed this nation into a costly war that maybe wasn't absolutely essential for our national security? And I guess you've already used the word Vietnam here, which probably comes to mind most quickly.
Vietnam is the most recent one, but the war that was actually the most unpopular and the war that we first lost was not Vietnam, it was the War of 1812, as I write about. Mm-hmm. And James Madison, who was one of those founders who tried to say presidents should not start wars on their own, and wars have to be popular, and they have to be for an overwhelming national security reason, he was the one who went to Congress and asked the Congress to go to war against the British, to stop them from harassing our ships, and also to conquer Canada. Well, you know, I'm sure that you have been to Canada at least in the last few years. It's still independent as far as I can check.
Yeah.
And it was a terribly unpopular war. So Madison, of all people, he was the one who broke the lock that the founders had put on the war power. James Polk in the 1840s had a fake skirmish in Texas, went to Congress and said, "We need a big war against the Mexicans." His ulterior motive was to add 1 million square miles of Mexican territory to the United States, make the country safe for slavery. 1898, William McKinley went to Congress and said, "We need a war against Spain because Spain sank our ship, the Maine, in Havana Harbor." Turns out the Maine was sunk by a boiler explosion, not the Spanish. And then, of course, as you're mentioning, LBJ in 1964, this ship that was supposedly attacked by the North Vietnamese. He went to Congress. He got a resolution, almost unanimous, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. But about 2 weeks later, Johnson privately found that there had been no such attack on an American ship. He never asked for the resolution back. And so LBJ and Nixon, for the next 9 years, waged the Vietnam War. It kills almost 60,000 Americans on the basis of a flimsy resolution based on an attack that never happened. The founders would cry.
You know, the impact of war on these presidents, it must be said, and you talk about this at length, the impact on these men has been profound. Some say Vietnam broke Lyndon Johnson. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would say that. They almost all have emotional and or physical breakdowns, and maybe LBJ most of all. And as you know, Steve, I've listened to the 700 hours of tapes that LBJ made of his private conversations, have done two books on them and used new ones for this book, Presidents of War. And what they show is that LBJ at the beginning, when he becomes president in 1963, is a pretty well-balanced, effective person. By 1967, he is getting paranoid. He's claiming on these private tapes that Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King are paying rioters in Chicago to embarrass LBJ. He's claiming that senators who oppose the war in Vietnam are doing so because Chinese and Soviet communists are stuffing cash into their pockets. He's claiming that the students against Vietnam on the campuses are protesting because Soviet KGB agents are behind them. He was not the same person he was at the beginning. And I think we owe a lot to Lady Bird Johnson, whom I got to know in her later years, because she knew how to pull LBJ out of these very frequent, almost debilitating depressions he had, almost getting into the bed and pulling the covers over his head for sometimes it seemed almost days. And more importantly, when Johnson got paranoid, when he got too excited, Lady Bird would say, for instance, "Lyndon, you know those FBI files that you're so excited about, they're full of unverified information. You shouldn't take them so seriously."
Presidential historian Michael Beschloss is my guest. His new book, Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times. The New York Times raved about this book, calling it superbly rendered. How did Harry Truman handle the rigors and the pressures of the Korean War, Michael?
He was actually one of the presidents who handled it better, both mentally and physically. And one reason was that wasn't that well known. It was known that Truman liked to walk a lot, but he also used exercise machines and, you know, did calisthenics. He was very careful about keeping himself in shape, especially because he was one of the older presidents of the United States. And the other thing is that here's a case of sort of human bites dog. Most politicians, most presidents, you find them in public claiming that they're very religious, and oftentimes in private, they turn out not to be quite as religious as they're claiming. In Truman's case, and it shows his character, was exactly the opposite. He didn't make a big thing about his religion in public, and the more we find about him in private is that he took great comfort from reading the Bible, reading the Psalms, knowing as much as he could about religion. Truman once said, "If you hear a politician praying too loud, go home and lock your smokehouse."
Sounds like advice. President Truman, yes.
Sure does.
Hey, how did you get thinking about presidents and this whole idea of waging war?
Well, you know, I'd written all these books that dealt with individual presidents and individual wars, but what I was really curious about is that there are only about 8 or 9 Americans in history who have been president and taken Americans into a major war, and I wanted to find out, did they have anything in common? One thing is, just as I'm saying with Truman, every single one of them became more religious. Abraham Lincoln, when he was a young man, was considered an atheist or perhaps an agnostic or certainly a scoffer at organized religion. And late in the Civil War, he's visited by an old friend from Illinois who is shocked to find Lincoln reading the Bible and says, "I can't believe what I'm seeing." And Lincoln says, "I don't know how anyone could go through the trauma of war without becoming more religious or finding some source of spiritual comfort." LBJ, for instance, was one of those politicians I'm talking about. For most of his life as a politician, he sure was photographed going to church. He was Disciples of Christ, but no evidence that it was a big part of his, that there was a lot of a spiritual life there. That changed as he had to deal with all those casualty figures. And Lady Bird Johnson, at the end of her life, told me that late in the Vietnam War, you know, one of their children, Lucy, had become a Catholic when she was 16. She had converted. And so Lady Bird told me of how Lucy had, unbeknownst to reporters, taken her father off to a small Catholic church in Southwest Washington, D.C., and how Lyndon had gotten such comfort from this that Lady Bird said, "At that point, I was really convinced that Lyndon was going to become a Catholic."
Well, that's a touching story. You mentioned Lincoln, and we were talking about the impact of war on these men. Lincoln suffering from debilitating depression, from headaches, he suffered as well.
He suffered, and that is something that we don't want presidents to suffer, but we sure want them to empathize with the troops who are fighting these wars, and not all of them in history do. In Lincoln's case, he was always prone to depression, as you know, but as these unbelievable number of casualties build up, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans dead on both sides, Lincoln was very emotionally connected to this. And as the war went on, his aides came to him and said, "There's so many people getting killed. We need to have a new national ceremony, cemetery. Where do you want it?" And Lincoln said, "Build it near my summer house, because I want every day at least once to see those Union graves being dug. It's going to be intensely painful to me, but I want to be confronted all the time with the terrible results of the terrible decisions that I'm making all the time." That's the kind of president you want, someone who never gets disconnected from the results of what he's doing.
You know, this book took you 10 years to complete. How come?
Mainly, I found that it was like researching 20 books in the end, which I didn't anticipate. Mm-hmm. You know, I have been writing books. My first book came out when I was 24 years old, so I've been doing this for a while. And I usually get it a little bit more right than I did this time. But what I found pretty quickly is in dealing with 8 or 9 presidents who were waging war, I couldn't just sort of read 3 books and go to a couple of manuscript collections. I wound up feeling as if I had to do each one as if I were researching a book on that president or that war alone. And the other thing is that the research is what I really love. For instance, you know, this book is not, as you know, just about presidents. It's about other big figures that were involved in these wars. And maybe I'll mention 2. I'll just do it quickly.
Sure.
One is in 1898, when the ship, the Maine, was sunk in Havana Harbor. The captain of the Maine was a guy named Dwight Sigsbee. And Sigsbee was not a bad captain, but unbelievably narcissistic and self-centered, to the point that just after the Maine sinks, he sends a message to his wife in Washington, which I found, saying essentially, "Maine is sunk, we've lost more than 200 men, and I've lost my entire wardrobe of clothing. I'll have to replace it." Gives you a little bit of an idea what kind of person he was.
Yes.
or Major Robert Anderson at the time of Fort Sumter. He was the commander of the federal troops inside the fort, and they were being attacked by the Confederacy, and the flag went down, and they surrendered, went to New York. Abraham Lincoln was worried that Anderson would be accused of having committed treason, given in to the Confederates, because he was a Southerner and maybe a secret Southerner. So Lincoln kept his distance. But Anderson gets to New York. There's a big celebration of him in Union Square, I think it was, about 100,000 people. Lincoln read about that and found that Anderson was pretty popular. So Lincoln gets in touch with Anderson, essentially says, "I've been meaning to write." You know, once Anderson is popular, Lincoln brings him to the White House and they have a big show of a meeting. And Lincoln says to Anderson, "Do you ever remember meeting me?" And Anderson says, "No, Mr. President, forgive me, I don't." And Lincoln says, "Well, you were the one who mustered me into service the only time I ever fought in a war, which was 1832, the Black Hawk War in Illinois." Lincoln remembered, Anderson did not, but Anderson, from that moment forward, was a Lincoln man till the day he died.
Oh, what a great story. What a great story. You also discussed Thomas Jefferson in here and his decision to refuse to go to war. What were you trying to say there?
What I was trying to say is that presidents who keep us out of unnecessary wars deserve as much credit as those who get us in. And in 1807, I tell the story of something called the Chesapeake and the Leopard, which has been too little known. I hope it'll become better known if people read my book. And what it was there was an attack by the British ship, the Leopard, on the Chesapeake, which was American. The Brits won. Americans were justifiably furious. I mean, it was even more intense than the anger after the sinking of the Maine. You know, Americans wanted a war with Britain in revenge for this terrible attack. And Thomas Jefferson later said, he was president, he said, "If I had wanted war, if I'd wanted to become a glorious war leader, all I would have had to do was open my hand, because Americans were just desperate to get involved in a war. But I knew that the reason was not important enough. We didn't have a cause of war, and I stopped it." Too often in American history, you've seen American presidents who wanted the glory of war to raise their poll numbers or to become a more, you know, conspicuous, beloved leader. And they have taken Americans into wars that maybe were not necessary. And the most sacred and the most basic and the most terrible decision an American president has to make is to send our young people into harm's way. Lyndon Johnson, whom I love for Medicare and I love him for voting rights and a lot of other things, one of the worst moments in the history of the presidency, I think, was at the beginning of 1965. And he's talking to Robert McNamara, his defense secretary, on the telephone. It's on one of these secret tapes.
Right.
And Johnson says, and he's just at the moment, he's sending large numbers of our young Americans, idealistic kids, to wage the war in Vietnam. But in private, he's saying, "I can't think of anything worse than losing the war in Vietnam, and I do not see any way that we can win."
Huh.
So you had this man who had a large heart, but how could he allow himself to send kids off under the pretext of fighting a war we're going to win?
That's Michael Beschloss, his new book, Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times. It's a New York Times bestseller once again. Michael, you're always welcome here. Thanks for taking some time. I sure enjoyed it.
Thanks. Loved our talk, Steve, as always.
Time for a break. Coming up, Mike, who Brian McTavish in his weekend to-do list. Something I can give in exchange for everything you give to me. She can sing. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on the weekend. Welcome back. How are you?
I am living through a quiet storm right now.
Which is
the voice of Anita Baker.
Wow. She's got the pipes.
I'll tell you, one of the queens of the 1980s quiet storm music radio format, which blended, you know, smooth R&B with other jazz-influenced music, Anita Baker was tops. Romantic R&B balladeer extraordinaire. She still can make a laid-back tempest when she lays into a lyric, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she retired. I did not know this. I think she quietly kind of, you know, hey, I've had enough. But apparently all those YouTube views, 20, 30 million, you know, people checking her out on YouTube, all these millennials, and they want a piece of that before it goes bye-bye. So Anita Baker has come out of retirement. She's going to do Giving You the Best That I Got, Sweet Love. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Caught Up in the Rapture. That's a nice thing if you can swing it. Big Group Hug. When, where, and how? Well, let me tell you, 8 o'clock Friday, Anita Baker, The Memories, Music Hall, 8 o'clock Friday. Something to do.
I hear some Prince.
It's time to go crazy.
Yes, it is.
And maybe some other things. Let's talk about a couple of things here in a row. One is Purple Rain, not R-A-I-N, but R-E-I-G-N, like a monarch.
Like a king.
Like a king. When Prince was, he was a prince, maybe he was a king too. Anyway, Purple Rain, Like a King, is the Prince-inspired stage comedy from who else? Late Night Theater here in Kansas City. Huh. It opens this weekend, 8 o'clock shows Friday and Saturday night, 6 o'clock pseudo matinee on Sunday at Missy B's in Midtown. And speaking of unusual approaches to classic material, well, it's that time of year again for the hip-hop Nutcracker, right? Pioneering rapper, and here's the cool part, right? Pioneering rapper Curtis Blow MCs this show. It's hip hop dancers doing their thing to the classic Tchaikovsky score. So I mean, not only do you get hip hop dancing in the Nutcracker, you get Curtis Blow, who had like the first gold record that was a rap record. 7 o'clock tonight, 7 o'clock at Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 outspoken things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's talk about a comedian, D.L. Hughley.
Hughley.
Looks like Hughley.
Maybe it is Hughley. Maybe I've been misinformed. Anyway, the very talented, the very skilled stand-up comedian, D.L. Hughley, and if I'm saying that wrong, the joke's on him. And he's a New York Times best-selling author, D.L. We'll just call him D.L. He definitely has a message for people in this country. He has an agenda, and it comes down to these two words, wake up, okay?
Hmm.
He's funny, but he's serious. Maybe let's hear a little of his thinking on first names.
Got to be careful with your name, your children. Giving a child the wrong name could be a disadvantage economically for the rest of their life. A recent survey of potential employees said the more ethnic or urban names sound, the less likely they'll even consider employing them. They throw those applications right in the trash. Got to know what a name means. My name is Daryl. That means beloved. My manager's name is Gary. That means warrior. Daquan means not hiring. People always go, what about Barack? He had an ethnic name and he ascended to the presidency. Well, Barack had two things behind his name, a lot of like Harvard and graduate.
for a guy who talks that fast, pretty good.
Yeah, he talks fast, but he's got a point. Okay, his latest humor-laden yet really dead serious book is called How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. Sorry, there's no protection against irony except maybe ignorance. DL, he's really focused, he's really talented, and he will make you laugh, maybe shed a tear for the way things are sometimes appearing to be going in our land today. But anyway, Friday night, 2 shows. Saturday night, 2 shows. Sunday, 1 show. Kansas City Improv Comedy Club, north of the river at Zona Rosa.
This is a cool event.
Yeah.
This is a sleeper, and people should know about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, would you like to tell them about
it? No, you go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Well,
this
is
your segment.
Have you?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Have you been to this before?
I have, and
so
it's
have
worth
I.
going to.
Have
yeah.
you bought anything?
I have.
Well, you're the big spender. Anyway, it's the KCAI, that's for Kansas City Art Institute, end of semester exhibition and sale. It's three opportunities. You've got 5 to 8 o'clock Friday, 10 to 5 Saturday, and 10 to 5 Sunday at the Kansas City Art Institute. Maybe you pick up a painting or a print or a
yeah,
sculpture.
It's cool.
Something that says, buy me. Listen to what the art is telling you. And all I have to say is all works of artistic genius must go in this sale.
Yes.
They must go.
And finally today.
And finally.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Okay, let's talk holidays.
Well, we almost made it till December.
Yes.
Not quite.
Almost.
Almost. It's the Parkville Christmas on the River. It's the 25th annual outdoor event in downtown Parkville overlooking the Missouri River. Hopefully it won't be too chilly from 6 to 10 Friday night.
A 1,000 voice
yeah.
choir? 1,000
yeah.
people.
They take all these kids, students, choral students in the Park Hill School District up north, and they put them together,
wow.
and they have one heck of a good time,
yes.
especially those who are listening. Look, you can be a family member, you can be a friend, or you can just be me or you being blown away by that 1,000 voice choir of students. It's a beautiful thing. And it's happening this weekend in Kansas City.
Okay, that's Brian McTavish with another very good weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Tomorrow, the film critics will be here with their reviews of independent, foreign, and documentary movies showing this holiday season. Also, Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker will swing by. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.